I need somebody. Help. Not just anybody. Help. You know I need someone.
Hi, everybody, and welcome to Martin Van Dyke Undercovers for March 2019, produced in partnership with the Ann Arbor District Library. This month's interview is with Thomas Brothers about his new book, Help, The Beatles, Duke Ellington, and the Magic of Collaboration. The Beatles and Duke Ellington's orchestra stand as the two greatest examples of collaboration in music history. If Duke Ellington was often reluctant to publicly acknowledge how essential collaboration was to the Ellington sound, the relationship between John Lennon and Paul McCartney of the Beatles was fluid from the start. Lennon and McCartney wrote for each other as primary audience. Lennon's preference for simpler music meant that it begged for enhancement, and McCartney was only too happy to oblige. And while McCartney expanded the Beatles' musical range, Lennon did the same thing with lyrics. Through his fascinating examination of the Beatles, Paul McCartney and John Lennon, along with Duke Ellington and his collaborators, especially Billy Strayhorn, author Thomas Brothers delivers a portrait of the creative process at work, demonstrating that the cooperative method at the foundation of these two artist groups was the primary reason for their unmatched musical success. I began my interview with Thomas Brothers by asking him how his book came about.
Well, there's several answers to that. The first answer is that I started writing this book when I was 8 years old. Meaning, you know, that I grew up with the Beatles, and they were very formative for me, and as many people of my generation. And so I've always lived with the Beatles, and when I was 12, I was convinced that I understood the Beatles in a way that nobody else really did.
Oh, you too.
But here at Duke, I've taught the Beatles for many years and taught Ellington for many years. So, and the little epiphany was when I realized that Lennon and McCartney were very close collaboratively in terms of the way they created their music, as everyone knows. But the epiphany was that I realized that the only two composers who were that close were Ellington and Strayhorn. And so, you know, all four of those are on the cover. The photos of those four musicians are on the cover of the book. And that's sort of the basis for the collaborative nexus, the mix that happens in these groups. And from there, I just realized that no one else has the same intensity, the same degree of collaboration as these two groups do. No one at this high level of achievement. And so in classical music, for example, and these groups, these composers are often compared to classical composers today. They have kind of a classical status, you could say. I mean, they've outlived the moment that they were successful in, and they reach across the generations and so forth. But no composer in classical music ever came anything close to the kind of exchange that these composers had. And so I argue that there are a bunch of reasons for this. The main reason is that the way these composers work together comes out of the African-American vernacular tradition, which is designed to be extremely interactive and designed to create social community on the spot through participatory music making. And so all of the great traditions in America that came out of this tradition, jazz and rock being maybe the two prominent ones, most prominent, they all have this collaborative dimension. And that is what Ellington and the Beatles are both building on and taking it in a certain direction. And so ultimately, I think the justification for my book is that I argue that collaboration is the best way to understand what these musicians accomplished. And it's the best lens to construct a narrative around what they did.
I know a bit more, being a baby boomer, about the Beatles and Duke Ellington. I certainly love Duke Ellington's music and have quite a bit of it in my collection. But I learned just so much about Duke Ellington in your book. And right on the book jacket, this statement, Duke Ellington's forte was not melody. I thought, wait a minute, is this a typo in this book? Of course it's not. And I thought, I assume Duke Ellington did everything, that he wrote all of the music and wrote lyrics to the tracks, the tunes that had lyrics, but that's very much not the case. So before we go anywhere else, what was Duke Ellington's forte? What was he good at, Tom?
Well, he was good at a lot of things, and this is actually the controversial side to my book, I think. I don't think there's going to be much controversy about accepting the Beatles as great collaborators, and the reason for that is that the Beatles themselves promoted that image. They liked the idea of an egalitarian rock and roll band where more or less equals. Now, of course, they weren't more or less equals. There was a hierarchy in the Beatles, but nevertheless, that was how they promoted themselves, and people loved that idea. They love the idea of these genuine, authentic group of friends having all this fun and creating this great music. Ellington's image is very different, and this is actually very controversial, I think. Ellington's image was established around 1930 by his manager of a great genius composer, and people started to write about Ellington that way immediately, and he started to get promoted that way. And that image has only intensified across the decades. Now, it's true that anybody who has seriously studied Ellington knows that there was a lot more to the story than that, and that he depended on a lot of people, his sidemen and Billy Strayhorn, especially, the trumpet player, the alto sax player, the clarinet player, the trombone player, and so on. All these sidemen made vital contributions, and a lot of them were melodies that Ellington then built great pieces around. So anybody, as I say, anybody who has studied Ellington knows about this, and they know that those co-composers, those collaborators, didn't get their names on the phonograph labels. They didn't get their names on the sheet music. Sometimes they did, sometimes they didn't. They certainly didn't get their names on publicity releases. So this was hidden. This was pushed into the background. And so this is well known, but still, to make a statement like that Ellington was not a great composer of melody, that's where the controversy comes in. And there's a lot of sides to this. One side is that we're never going to know for sure who did what. All this took place off of the written record. We have a lot of information, but it's sketchy, and we don't always know the true story. And so a lot of people have a lot of investment in Ellington being the great genius composer, and I'm talking about writers now and true diehard fans, and that's how he has become the cultural hero that he has become. But what I'm saying is that actually we need to reassess that, and I'm building on now a lot of great work that's been done over the last few decades, especially work on Billy Strayhorn, but also work on the sidemen. We now have biography of Juan Tiesel, for example, the great trombonist. We have a biography of Ben Webster, the great tenor saxophone player, and so forth. And so the story, a lot of the details of the story are much clearer now than they used to be. So my position is that what would it look like to consider Ellington as a genius collaborator who was at the center of this incredible mix of talent and knew how to put that in motion, had the personal savvy to really make that work and to make people feel like they want to contribute to this enterprise, even though their names might not get put on the composition, even though they might not get royalties, there might be other benefits for them, and so forth. So that was the interpersonal side of it. And then on the musical side of it, Ellington had incredible musical strengths. He was very gifted in terms of exploring harmonic language, which a lot of jazz musicians were. He's a very skillful arranger, and certainly he wrote great compositions that by himself. But my argument is that the greatest Ellington achievements tend not to be solo items. They tend to be collaborative items, which involve his sidemen.
We'll talk more about Duke Ellington, but let's talk about the Beatles a bit here. Of course, John and Paul, the main collaborators in the Beatles, along with Ringo and George. But you go out of your way to talk about how important the collaborations were between the band and their manager, Brian Epstein, and their producer, George Martin. What made George and Brian such important collaborators with the Beatles?
Well, Lennon and McCartney met each other in 1956. I'm giving a long answer.
That's fine.
Lennon and McCartney met in 1956. Lennon was 16 years old, and McCartney was 14. And they started collaborating right away. They started writing pieces together right away. And this was successful, and they loved it, and they both understood the benefit to each other. And so they became so used to collaborating, it was very easy for them to bring in ideas and energy from other musicians, including, of course, the musicians who worked with them, but also their manager, Brian Epstein, as you mentioned, and their studio producer, George Martin. Now, Epstein saw the band in 62, and decided to manage them, even though he didn't have any musical training, really. He was a theater guy, and his family owned some businesses. They were businessmen, independent businessmen, and Epstein had a record store. And so he was very interested in music, and he saw what was selling and saw what was good and so forth. So I'm not sure how much Epstein really shaped them musically in terms of collaboration. There's some shadowy evidence that he maybe exerted some influence on repertory early on, and sort of steered them towards the middle of the road in order to get record contracts, that kind of thing, although the Beatles denied this. They said their repertorial choices were their own. Martin, however, was a true force of collaboration, and no one has ever denied that, although, again, it's not always clear exactly what Martin contributed, what he didn't contribute. When we have classical touches like, let's say, Penny Lane with a great trumpet solo. Martin's background is highly classical, intensely classical, and he tutors them in that side of the musical world. So when we have something like that in Penny Lane, people tend to think that's Martin, but actually that was McCartney's melody, McCartney's idea to put that trumpet solo in there. So I'm just saying that a lot of the automatic assumptions about what Martin did and didn't do, when you look at it more closely, doesn't really come through. But there's no question that Martin tutored them. He gave them ideas, like any record producer. So this was a standard practice in the music business, that the record producer called the shots. He told you what pieces you were going to record. He might change them around. He might change chords, even. He might change the introduction. He might change the ending. He might add string arrangements, so forth, all kinds of things. The record producer represents the company's interests. He represents the interests of the record company, and they're putting a lot of money out there to get your name out there and to get you famous. And so everybody went along with this. The Beatles said, we'll do what you say. And so that was very standard. And Martin actually turned out to be just the right guy for them, because he was confident enough and humble enough and flexible enough that he could go along with their interests and their abilities and their ideas. He once said that I recognized that an idea coming from them was better than an idea coming from me. Hmm. Well, not all record producers would have said that, and they wouldn't have been able to go along with that kind of situation, but Martin did, to his credit. So he's a big part of their success, undoubtedly.
Tom, the working idea behind John and Paul's relationship, John the edgy one, the rocker, the hard edge guy, and Paul the sweet, the tuneful, the sentimental person, it kind of sounds like oil and water, and yet for so many years... They blended together perfectly. What was the magic of that? Were they really all that different? Is that just sort of one of the many Beatles myths and fables that we've been believing all these years?
Well, there's a little bit of truth to it, sure, but there's much more to the story than that, that's for sure. And they, you know, with Lennon being a couple years older than McCartney, and he was the leader of the band when McCartney went into it, the hierarchy there was pretty clear. And so McCartney accepted that, basically. McCartney accepted Lennon as the leader of the band and so forth. Lennon, on the other hand, accepted, in my view, McCartney's musical superiority. And he realized that any time he could hand over his piece, his song that he was creating, to McCartney, who would then rework it, the results were going to improve. And so this was kind of a dynamic that got established. On the other hand, McCartney recognized Lennon's superiority in words. Lennon, of course, was a poet who published several books of poetry, and his stepmother, or his aunt Mimi, who was his guardian and raised him, said that he was constantly scribbling down lyrics in the house and poems and such, and tearing them up and starting a new one, so forth, reworking them, drafting them. Lennon was extremely gifted in terms of verbal fluidity. And so anytime McCartney was open to Lennon's improvements of his lyrics, there's no doubt about that. And then, of course, they also composed songs together. They one will have an A section, the main section of a song, and the other will have a bridge, the contrasting section, and they'll put them together. They did that from the very beginning, and they did that until the very end. There's no doubt about that. So they found lots of different ways of working together, and they had this sort of mutual understanding about how they were going to work together, how they were going to respect each other, what each other's strengths were, and so forth. So it was a very productive relationship.
Mm. Let's go back to the subject of Duke Ellington. And is it fair to say his greatest collaborator, Billy Strayhorn? Is that your feeling, Tom? And could you tell us more, give us a little thumbnail biography of Billy Strayhorn?
Well, that was one of the things that made my book possible, is all the work, that the great work that's been done on Billy Strayhorn. There were a couple books came out around the year 2000 that really looked closely at what Strayhorn did and put him forward as a much more important part of the Ellington achievement than had been previously thought. And they got really into the details of who wrote what and so forth. And so I was building on that. Ellington and Strayhorn met in 1938 when Ellington was almost 40 years old and the most famous composer in jazz by far. Strayhorn was 23 years old and a complete unknown. And Ellington recognized his talent, which Ellington was one of Ellington's great gifts again, and wanted to put him in his band, and or to put him behind the scenes in his band as an orchestrator, as an arranger, as someone who would work with singers, someone who would work with small group recording sessions, and so forth. The Ellington Enterprise was very multidimensional, very multifaceted, and so it was natural for Ellington to think of someone this gifted to work with, to help him out and all these different projects that were going on. Ellington also realized that Strayhorn had command of classical music in a way that he himself did not. And this was a great benefit. Strayhorn had incredible fluency with classical theory and with modern classical music, music by Stravinsky, music by Bartok, people like that. And Ellington had very limited understanding of this kind of music. But Ellington was constantly reaching for a modern sound and also a sophisticated sound, a sophisticated jazz, the jazz that is like classical music. Ellington had long, during the 1930s, had clearly established this side, this niche for himself within jazz. So Strayhorn fit perfectly into that as well. And they worked together for 30 years, off and on. It wasn't flawlessly wonderful for everyone. And Strayhorn was dissatisfied at several important turns during that period. He actually left Ellington for a while and then came back. And Strayhorn was not completely happy either with being pushed into the background. But when you think about it, Strayhorn also benefited tremendously from Ellington. I mean, Ellington really gave him a lot of freedom and gave him a lot of encouragement. So it's a complex relationship and a fascinating one. But it's the most important of Ellington's collaborators. Absolutely, Strayhorn is.
Let's close out by talking about one of Billy Strayhorn's greatest compositions for Duke Ellington, Chelsea Bridge, and then one of the greatest John Paul collaborations with the Beatles, Strawberry Fields Forever. Yeah, I grew up, I'm a rocker, but Tom, I also would listen to a lot of jazz, and all my friends in my rock band, we gravitated towards this Chelsea Bridge song as something that was so magical and mysterious, certainly not rock and roll, but we would just listen to that song over and over in silence going, this is genius. This is magical. What's going on in this tune? Give us some of your expert analysis about Chelsea Bridge by Billy Strayhorn. Did he get credit for this song, or did Duke Ellington call it a Duke Ellington composition?
Yes, Strayhorn got credit.
Oh, good.
Yes. Although I can't remember if Ellington might have put his name on it. It's actually very confusing because a lot of Strayhorn things, it's very unpredictable. We don't really understand the logic. Sometimes it's just Strayhorn's name. Sometimes it's just Ellington's name. Sometimes it's both of their names. And those are cases where Strayhorn did the whole thing. We don't really know what was going on there in the background. But that's a great example of Strayhorn's interest in contemporary classical music, modern classical music, like music by Ravel, for example. That comes through in Chelsea Bridge. The harmonies, the way the chords work in that song. It's very powerful and very mystical, almost. Strayhorn said he was inspired by an impressionist painting for that. And so you can see his interest in the arts. Strayhorn is very learned and studied theater, studied plays, loved Shakespeare, studied classical music like Tchaikovsky. That kind of interest comes through in the 1950s suites and so forth. But yeah, that's a great example of a tune that was very popular. Mm. Strawberry Fields, you mentioned.
Yeah, yeah.
Both of these compositions, the ones you just picked, you know, they show both of these groups, you know, inching towards classical music, at music that it will be received as in sophistication and innovation as something like classical music. And Strawberry Fields Forever is a great example. That's one of my favorite pieces as an example of a piece that can only exist in the recording studio. And this is something the Beatles are obviously very famous for. That they are, in 1966, they get tired of touring, and they say that, well, we're going to create records, LP records, that really aren't going to be performed, and that everything that's happening here is a product of the studio. And Strawberry Fields Forever is a terrific example of that, and a song that started as a song by Lennon, as a fairly simple song musically, very simple song, I would say. If you have a chance, you can sometime hear it, listen to Lennon performing a demo version of that as he's emerging from his mind, is accompanying himself on acoustic guitar. And you say, okay, that's so simple. How did you get from there to the extremely complex final result? And the way you get there is by collaboration. And that's the main argument of the book.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, beautiful. Nicely done. Wish I had more time to talk to you, Tom. This is just fascinating.
Well, thank you, Martin.
It really is. Oh, I got to ask you, have you ever had a chance to track down Carnival of Light, this like famously unheard Beatles track? Were you able to find that anywhere and listen to it?
I did hear it on the web once. You know, I don't have a real strong memory of it. It was one of the things that McCartney did as a sort of experimental electronic piece, an avant-garde kind of, the kind of thing that surfaces on Sgt. Pepper in A Day in the Life, for example. But McCartney never intended that to be released as a commercial product. And so that's why we don't know about it. But it indicates, you know, the kind of direction they were going in early 1967.
Right, right. And it also does that indicate, everyone always thinks, Lennon, the experimenter, the one on the edge, but it was Paul, right? Who was the person in a Stockhaus and the, you know, avant-garde music, that he was the one who had the biggest interest in that, right?
That's definitely the case. Mm-hmm. And McCartney, in this sense, is like Strayhorn, from 20, 30 years earlier. He's interested in the most cutting-edge classical music. He's interested in a lot of classical music. And he's getting that partly at home. He's living with his girlfriend, Jane Asher, in her house, which is is always an interesting thing to me. Jay Hesher was barely 18, 19 years old when this started. Her parents were very progressive, but her parents were also intellectuals and very aware of cutting-edge London. And Jay Hesher's brother, Peter Hesher, was a Cambridge-trained musician who was plugged into these circles. All these people, the Hesher family, helped McCartney get plugged into the cutting-edge circles of London, and that included music like Carl Stockhausen, as you said.
There's just so many Duke Ellington albums, compilations, and for someone just getting into his music or someone who wants to get some decent overview of his career or one aspect of his career, what do you recommend?
Wow, that's a very hard one to tackle because, I mean, we're talking about a career that went from 1923 to around 1970. So there's a lot of Ellington out there.
Yeah, there really is.
It's amazing, actually. So anybody who reads my book, every Ellington piece I talk about is on YouTube. You can hear every single one of those pieces
sure.
for free.
Oh, yeah.
Just dial it up on YouTube. You have to be precise about the date because Ellington re-recorded a lot of these tunes again and again, so maybe dozens of times.
Right.
And so you have to be clear about which version of it you're getting. On the other hand, the Beatles, no way.
Yeah.
You're not going to get that stuff on YouTube.
Yeah, really, exactly. I discovered Ellington's Daybreak Express by reading your book, and I wasn't familiar with that Ellington track, which I should have been, and I'm a big fan of Trains, and I just listened to that for the first time the other day, and it's just divine. It is so evocative.
It blows you away, doesn't
of
it,
train
Mark?
Travel.
It's an amazing accomplishment.
How
yeah.
do you do that? I was just replaying it again, getting ready for the interview, and my coworker was like, where are you going? Where's your destination, Martin? You know, you stopping in Chicago. I mean, it's so like, how do you do that? How does someone do that in music and make it so real? It's uncanny. Oh,
well, it's not the only train piece, and it's in fact not the only train piece from the Ellington Orchestra, and it may not even be the best train piece because we have Take the A Train.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, there's that one too. Yeah, that's pretty good. Thanks for listening to Martin Bandyke Undercovers for March 2019. Our interview was with Thomas Brothers about Help, the Beatles, Duke Ellington, and the magic of collaboration. This has been a presentation of the Ann Arbor District Library. We'll be right back.